Can you tell from this distance? Pye said. I know, damn it! Beatrix is burning. We have to go back. He climbed onto his doikai and started to haul it around on the narrow path. Wait, said Pye. Wait for God's sake. We have to help them, Gentle said, against the rock face. They were good to us. Only because they wanted us out, Pye replied. Well, now the worst's happened, and we have to do what we can. You used to be more rational than this. What do you mean, used to be? You don't know anything about me, so don't start making judgments. If you won't come with me, fuck you. The doikai was fully turned now, and Gentle dug his heels into its flanks to make it pick up speed. There had only been three or four places along the route where the road had divided. He was certain he could retrace their steps back to Beatrix without much problem, and if he was right, and it was the town that was burning up ahead, he would have the column of smoke as a grim marker. The mischief followed after a time, as Gentle knew it must. It was happy to be called a friend, but somewhere in its soul it was a slave. They didn't speak as they travelled, which was not surprising given their last exchange. Only once, as they mounted a ridge that laid the vista of foothills before them, with the valley in which Beatrix nestled still out of sight, but unequivocally the source of the smoke, did Pye O'Parr murmur, "Why is it always fire?" And Gentle realized how insensitive he'd been to his companion's reluctance to return. The devastation that undoubtedly lay before them was an echo of the fire in which its adopted family had perished, a matter that had gone undiscussed between them since. "Shall I go from here without you?" he asked. The mischief shook its head. "Together, or not at all," it said. The route became easier to negotiate from there on. The inclines were mellower, and the track itself better kept, but there was also light in the sky, as the long-delayed dawn finally came. By the time they finally laid their eyes on the remains of Beatrix, the peacock-tail glory Gentle had first admired in the heavens over Parashokwa was overhead, its glamour making grimmer still the scene laid below. Beatrix was still burning fitfully, but the fire had consumed most of the houses and their birch-bamboo arbours. He brought his doikai to a halt and scoured the place from this vantage point. There was no sign of Beatrix's destroyers. "On foot from here?" Gentle said. "I think so." They tethered the beasts and descended into the village. The sound of lamentation reached them before they were within its perimeters, the sobbing emerging as it did from the murk of the smoke, reminding Gentle of the sounds he'd heard while keeping his vigil on the hill. The destruction around them now was somehow a consequence of that sightless encounter, he knew. Though he'd avoided the eye of the watcher in the darkness, his presence had been suspected, and that had been enough to bring this calamity upon Beatrix.
"I'm responsible," he said. "God help me, I'm responsible."
He turned to the mischief, who was standing in the middle of the street, its features drained of blood and expression.
"Stay here," Gentle said. "I'm going to find the family."
Pye didn't register any response, but Gentle assumed what he'd said had been understood and headed off in the direction of the Splendid's house. It wasn't simply fire that had undone Beatrix. Some of the houses had been toppled, unburned, the copses around them uprooted. There was no sign of fatalities, however, and Gentle began to hope that coaxial Tasco had persuaded the villagers to take to the hills before Beatrix's violators had appeared out of the night. That hope was dashed when he came to the place where the Splendid's home had stood. It was rubble, like the others, and the smoke from its burning timbers had concealed from him until now the horror heaped in front of it. Here were the good people of Beatrix, shovelled together in a bleeding pile higher than his head. There were a few sobbing survivors at the heap, looking for their loved ones in the confusion of broken bodies, some clutching at limbs they thought they recognised, others simply kneeling in the bloody dirt, keening. Gentle walked around the pile, searching among the mourners for a face he knew. One fellow he'd seen laughing at the show was cradling in his arms a wife or sister, whose body was as lifeless as the puppets he'd taken such pleasure in. Another, a woman, was burrowing in among the bodies, yelling somebody's name. He went to help her, but she screamed at him to stay away. As he retreated, he caught sight of Efreet. The boy was in the heap,
his eyes open, his mouth, which had been the vehicle for such unalloyed enthusiasms, beaten in by a rifle butt or a boot. At that moment, Gentle wanted nothing, not life itself, as much as he wanted the bastard who'd done this, standing in his sights. He felt the killing breath hot in his throat, itching to be merciless. He turned from the heap, looking for some target, even if it wasn't the murderer himself. Someone with a gun or a uniform, a man he could call the enemy. He couldn't remember ever feeling this way before. But then he'd never possessed the power he had now. Or rather, if Pi was to be believed, he'd had it without recognizing the fact. And agonizing as these horrors were, it was salve to his distress, knowing there was such a capacity for cleansing in him, that his lungs, throat, and palm could take the guilty out of life with such ease. He headed away from the cairn of flesh, ready to be an executioner at the first invitation. The street twisted, and he followed its convolutions, turning a corner to find the way ahead blocked by one of the invaders' war machines. He stopped in his tracks, expecting it to turn its steel eyes upon him. It was a perfect deathbringer, armoured as a crab, its wheels bristling with blooded scythes, its turret with armaments. But death had found the bringer. Smoke rose from the turret, and the driver lay where the fire had found him, in the act of scrabbling for the machine's stomach. A small victory, but one that at least proved the machines had frailties. Come another day, that knowledge might be the difference between hope and despair. He was turning his back on the machine when he heard his name called, and Tasco appeared from behind the smoking carcass. Wretched he was, his face blooded, his clothes filthy with dust.
"Bad timing, Zacharias," he said. "You're left too late, and now you come back too late again."
"Why did they do this?"
"The Autarch doesn't need reasons."
"He was here," Gentle said.
The thought that the butcher of Isordarex had stood in Beatrix made his heart beat faster. But Tasco said,
"Who knows? Nobody's ever seen his face. Maybe he was here yesterday, counting the children, and nobody even noticed him."
"Do you know where Mother Splendid is?"
"In the heap somewhere."
"Jesus.
She wouldn't have made a very good witness. She was too crazy with grief. They left alive the ones who tell the story best. Atrocities need witnesses, Zacharias. People to spread the word."
"They did this as a warning," Gentle said.
Tasco shook his huge head.
"I don't know how their minds work," he said.
"Maybe we have to learn, so we can stop them."
"I'd prefer to die," the man replied, "than understand filth like that. If you've got the appetite, then go to Isordarex. You'll get the education there."
"I want to help here," Gentle said. "There must be something I can do."
"You can leave us to mourn."
If there was any profounder dismissal, Gentle didn't know it. He searched for some word of comfort or apology, but in the face of such devastation, only silence seemed appropriate. He bowed his head and left Tasco to the burden of being a witness, returning up the street past the heap of corpses to where Pi O'Pa was standing. The mistiff hadn't moved an inch, and even when Gentle came abreast of it and quietly told it they should go, it was a long time before it looked round at him.
"We shouldn't have come back," it said. "Every day we waste, this is going to happen again."
"You think we can stop it?"
Pi said, with a trace of sarcasm.
"We won't go the long way around. We'll go through the mountains, save ourselves 3 weeks."
"You do, don't you?" Pi said. "You think we can stop this?"
"We won't die," Gentle said, putting his arms around Pi O'Pa. "I won't let us. I came here to understand, and I will."
"How much more of this can you take?"
"As much as I have to."
"I may remind you of that."
"I'll remember," Gentle said. "After this, I'll remember everything."
Chapter 21 1 The retreat at the Godolphin estate had been built in an age of follies. when the oldest sons of the rich and mighty, having no wars to distract them, amused themselves spending the gains of generations on buildings whose only function was to flatter their egos. Most of these lunacies, designed without care for basic architectural principles, were dust before their designers. A few, however, became noteworthy even in neglect, either because somebody associated with them had lived or died in notoriety, or because they were the scene of some drama. The Retreat fell into both categories. Its architect, Geoffrey Light, had died within 6 months of its completion, choked by a bull's pizzle in the wilds of West Riding, a grotesquerie which attracted some attention, as did the retirement from the public eye of Light's patron, Lord Joshua Godolphin, whose decline into insanity was the talk of court and coffee-house for many years. Even at his zenith he'd attracted gossip, mainly because he kept the company of magicians. Cagliostro, the Comte de Saint-Germain, and even Casanova, reputedly no mean thaumaturgist, had spent time on the estate, as well as a host of lesser-known practitioners. His lordship had made no secret of his occult investigations, though the work he was truly undertaking was never known to the gossips. They assumed he kept company with these mountebanks for their entertainment value. Whatever his reasons, the fact that he retired from sight so suddenly drew further attention to his last indulgence, the folly Light had built for him. A diary purporting to have belonged to the choked architect appeared a year after his demise, containing an account of the retreat's construction. Whether it was the genuine article or not, it made bizarre reading. The foundations had been laid, it said, under stars calculated to be particularly propitious. The masons, sought and hired in a dozen cities, had been sworn to silence with an oath of Arabic ferocity. The stones themselves had been individually baptized in a mixture of milk and frankincense, and a lamb had been allowed to wander through the half-completed building 3 times, the altar and font placed where it had laid its innocent head. Of course, these details were soon corrupted by repetition and satanic purpose ascribed to the building. It became baby's blood that was used to anoint the stone, and a mad dog's grave that marked the spot where the altar was built. Sealed up behind the high walls of his sanctum, it was doubtful that Lord Godolphin even knew that such rumours were circulating, until, 2 Septembers after his withdrawal, the inhabitants of Yoke, the village closest to the estate, needing a scapegoat to blame the poor harvest upon and inflamed by a passage from Ezekiel delivered from the pulpit of the parish church, used the Sunday afternoon to mount a crusade against the devil's work, and climbed the gates of the estate to raise the retreat. They found none of the promised blasphemies, no inverted cross, no altar stained with virginal blood. But having trespassed, they did what damage they could inflict out of sheer frustration, finally setting a bonfire of baled hay in the middle of the great mosaic. All the flames did was lick the place black, and the retreat earned its nickname from that afternoon, the Black Chapel, or Godolphin's Sin. 2. If Jude had known anything about the history of Yoke, she might well have looked for signs of its echoes in the village as she drove through. She would have had to look hard, but the signs were there to be found. There was scarcely a house within its bounds that didn't have a cross carved into the keystone above the door, or a horseshoe cemented into the doorstep. If she'd had time to linger in the churchyard, she would have found, inscribed on the stones there, entreaties to the good Lord that he keep the devil from the living even as he gathered the dead to his bosom, and on the board beside the gate a notice announcing that next Sunday's sermon would be The Lamb in Our Lives, as though to banish any lingering thought of the infernal goat. She saw none of these signs, however. It was the road and the man at her side, with occasional words of comfort directed towards the dog on the back seat, that consumed her attention. Getting Estabrook to bring her here had been a spur-of-the-moment inspiration, but there was sound logic behind it. She would be his freedom for a day, taking him out of the clinic's stale heat into the bracing January air. It was her hope that out in the open he might talk more freely about his family, and more particularly about Brother Oscar. What better place to innocently inquire about the Godolphins and their history than in the grounds of the house Charlie's forefathers had built? The estate lay half a mile beyond the village, along a private road that led to a gateway besieged even in this sterile season by a green army of bushes and creepers. The gates themselves had long ago been removed, and a less elegant defence against trespassers raised, boards and corrugated iron covered with barbed wire. The storms of early December had brought down much of this barricade, however, and once the car was parked and they both approached the gateway, Skin bounding ahead, yapping joyously, it became apparent that as long as they were willing to brave brambles and nettles, access could be readily gained.
"It's a sad sight," she remarked. "It must have been magnificent."
"Not in my time," Estabrook said.
"Shall I beat the way through?"
she suggested, picking up a fallen branch and stripping off the twigs to do so.
"No, let me,"
he replied, relieving her of the switch and clearing a path for them by flaying the nettles mercilessly. Jude followed in his green wake, a kind of exhilaration seizing her as she drew closer to stepping between the gateposts, a feeling she ascribed to the sight of Estabrook so heartily engaged in this adventure. He was a very different man to the husk she'd seen slumped in a chair 2 weeks before. As she clambered through the debris of fallen timbers, he offered her his hand, and like lovers in search of some trysting place, they slipped through the broken barrier into the estate beyond. She was expecting an open vista, a driveway leading the eye to the house itself. Indeed, once she might have enjoyed just such a view, but 200 years of ancestral insanities, mismanagement, and neglect had given symmetry over to chaos, parkland to pampas. What had once been artfully placed copses, built for shady dalliance, had spread and become choked woods. Lawns once levelled to perfection were wildernesses now. Several other members of England's landed gentry, finding themselves unable to sustain the family manse, had turned their estates into safari parks, importing the fauna of lost empire to wander where deer had grazed in better-heeled times. To Jude's eye, the effect of such efforts was always pathetic. The parks were always too tended, the oaks and sycamores an inappropriate backdrop for lion or baboon. But here, she thought, it was possible to imagine wild beasts roaming. It was like a foreign landscape, dropped in the middle of England. It was a long walk to the house, but Estabrook was already leading the way with Skin as scout. What visions were in Charlie's mind's eye, Jude wondered, that drove him on with such gusto? The past, perhaps? Childhood visits here? Or further back still to the days of High Yoke's glory, when the route they were taking had been raked gravel, and the house ahead a gathering place for the wealthy and the influential?
"Did you come here a lot when you were little?" she asked him as they ploughed through the grass.
He looked around at her with a moment's bewilderment, as though he'd forgotten she was with him.
"Not often," he said. "I liked it, though. It was like a playground. Later on I thought about selling it, but Oscar would never let me. He had his reasons, of course."
"What were they?" she asked him lightly.
"Frankly, I'm glad we left it to run to seed. It's prettier this way."
He marched on, wielding his branch like a machete. As they drew closer to the house, Jude could see what a pitiful state it was in. The windows were gone, the roof was reduced to a timber lattice, the doors teetered on their hinges like drunks. All sad enough in any house, but near tragic in a structure that had once been so magnificent. The sunlight was getting stronger as the clouds cleared, and by the time they stepped through the porch, it was pouring through the lattice overhead, its geometry a perfect foil for the scene below. The staircase, albeit rubble-strewn, still rose in a sweep to a half-landing, which had once been dominated by a window fit for a cathedral. It was smashed now, by a tree toppled many winters before, the withered extremities of which lay on the spot where the lord and lady would have paused before descending to greet their guests. The panelling of the hallway and the corridors that led off it was still intact, and the boards solid beneath their feet. Despite the decay of the roof, the structure didn't look unsound. It had been built to serve Godolphins in perpetuity, the fertility of land and loin preserving the name until the sun went out. It was flesh that had failed it, not the other way about. Estabrook and Skin wandered off in the direction of the dining room, which was the size of a restaurant. Jude followed a little way but found herself drawn back to the staircase. All she knew about the period in which the house had flourished, she'd culled from films and television, but her imagination rose to the challenge with astonishing ardour, painting mind pictures so intense they all but displaced the dispiriting truth. When she climbed the stairs, indulging, somewhat guiltily, her dreams of aristocracy, she could see the hallway below lit with the glow of candles, could hear laughter on the landing above, and, as she descended, the sigh of silk as her skirts brushed the carpet. Somebody called to her from a doorway, and she turned expecting to see Esterbrook, but the caller was imagined, and the name, too. Nobody had ever called her Peach Plum. The moment unsettled her slightly, and she went after Esterbrook as much to reacquaint herself with solid reality as for his company. He was in what had surely been a ballroom, one wall of which was a line of ceiling-high windows, offering a view across terraces and formal gardens to a ruined gazebo. She went to his side and put her arm through his. Their breaths became a common cloud, gilded by the sun through the shattered glass.
"It must have been so beautiful," she said.
"I'm sure it was," he sniffed hard. "But it's gone forever."
"It could be restored.
For a fortune. You've got a fortune. Not that big.
What about Oscar?
No, this is mine. He can come and go, but it's mine. That was part of the deal."
"What deal?" she said.
He didn't reply. She pressed him with words and proximity.
"Tell me," she said. "Share it with me."
He took a deep breath.
"I'm older than Oscar, and there's a family tradition. It goes back to the time when this house was intact, which says the oldest son, or daughter if there are no sons, becomes a member of a society called the Tabula Rasa."
"I've never heard of it."
"That's the way they like it to stay, I'm sure. I shouldn't be telling you any of this, but what the hell? I don't care any more. It's all ancient history. So, I was supposed to join the Tabula Rasa, but I was passed over by Papa in favour of Oscar."
"Why?"
Charlie made a little smile.
"Believe it or not, they thought I was unstable. Me, can you imagine? They were afraid I'd be indiscreet."
The smile became a laugh.
"Well, fuck them all. I'll be indiscreet."
"What does the society do?"
"It was founded to prevent, let me remember the words exactly, to prevent the tainting of England's soil. Joshua loved England."
"Joshua?"
"The Godolphin who built this house."
"What did he think this taint was?"
"Who knows? Catholics? The French? He was crazy, and so were most of his friends. Secret societies were in vogue back then."
"And it's still in operation?"
"I suppose so. I don't talk to Oscar very often, and when I do, it's not about the Tabula Rasa. He's a strange man. In fact, he's a lot crazier than me. He just hides it better."
"You used to hide it very well, Charlie," she reminded him.
"More fool me. I should have let it out. I might have kept you."
He put his hand up to her face.
"I was stupid, Judith. I can't believe my luck that you've forgiven me."
She felt a pang of guilt, hearing him so moved by her manipulations. But they'd at least borne fruit. She had two new pieces for the puzzle, the Tabula Rasa and its raison d'être.
"Do you believe in magic?"
she asked him.
"Do you want the old, Charlie, or the new one?"
"The new. The crazy."
"Then yes, I think I do. When Oscar used to bring his little presents round, he'd say to me, 'Have a piece of the miracle.' I used to throw most of them out, except for the bits and pieces you found. I didn't want to know where he got them."
"You never asked him," she said.
"I did, finally. One night when you were away and I was drunk, he came round with that book you found in the safe, and I asked him outright where he got this smut from. I wasn't ready to believe what he told me. You know what made me ready?"
"No, what?"
"The body on the heath. I told you about it, didn't I? I watched them digging around in the muck and the rain for 2 days, and I kept thinking, what a fucking life this is. No way out except feet first. I was ready to slit my wrists, and I probably would have done it except that you appeared, and I remembered the way I felt about you when I first saw you. I remembered feeling as though something miraculous was happening, as though I was reclaiming something I'd lost. And I thought, if I believe in one miracle, I may as well believe in them all. Even Oscar's. Even his talk about the Imagica, and the dominions in the Imagica, and the people there, and the cities. I just thought, why not? Embrace it all before I lose the chance. Before I'm a body lying out in the rain. You won't die in the rain. I don't care where I die, Jude. I care where I live. I want to live in some kind of hope. I want to live with you.
Charlie, she chided softly, we shouldn't talk about that now.
Why not? What better time? I know you brought me here because you've got questions of your own you want answering, and I don't blame you. If I'd seen that damn assassin come after me, I'd be asking questions too. But think about it, Judy. That's all I'm asking. Think about whether the new Charlie's worth a little bit of your time. Will you do that?
I'll do that.
Thank you,
he said, and taking the hand she tucked through his arm, he kissed her fingers.
You've had most of Oscar's secrets now, he said. You may as well know them all. See the little wood way over towards the wall? That's his little railway station, where he takes the train to wherever he goes.
I'd like to see it.
Shall we stroll over there, ma'am? He said. Where did the dog go?
He whistled, and Skin came pounding in, raising golden dust.
Perfect. Let's take the air.
3. The afternoon was so bright, it was easy to imagine what bliss this place would be, even in its present decay, come spring or high summer, with dandelion seeds and birdsong in the air, and the evenings long and balmy. Though she was eager to see the place Esterbrook had described as Oscar's railway station, she didn't force the pace. They strolled, just as Charlie had suggested, taking time to cast an appreciative glance back towards the house. It looked even grander from this aspect, with the terraces rising to the row of ballroom windows. Though the wood ahead was not large, the undergrowth and the sheer density of trees kept their destination from sight until they were under the canopy and treading the damp rot of last September's fall. Only then did she realize what building this was. She'd seen it countless times before, drawn in elevation and hanging in front of the safe.
"The retreat," she said. "You recognize it?"
"Of course."
Birds sang in the branches overhead, misled by the warmth and tuning up for courtship. When she looked up, it seemed to her the branches formed a fretted vault above the retreat, as if echoing its dome. Between the two, vault and song, the place felt almost sacred.
"Oscar calls it the Black Chapel," Charlie said. "Don't ask me why."
It had no windows, and from this side, no door. They had to walk around it a few yards before the entrance came in sight. Skin was panting at the step, but when Charlie opened the door, the dog declined to enter.
"Coward,"
Charlie said, preceding Jude over the threshold.
"It's quite safe."
The sense of the numinous she'd felt outside was stronger still inside. But despite all that she'd experienced since Pai O'Pa had come for her life, she was still ill-prepared for mystery. Her modernity burdened her. She wished there was some forgotten self she could dredge from her crippled history, better equipped for this. Charlie had his bloodline, even if he'd denied his name. The thrushes in the trees outside resembled absolutely the thrushes who'd sung here since these boughs had been strong enough to bear them. But she was adrift, resembling nobody, not even the woman she'd been 6 weeks ago.
"Don't be nervous,"
Charlie said, beckoning her in. He spoke too loudly for the place. His voice carried around the vast, bare circle and came back to meet him magnified. He seemed not to notice. Perhaps it was simply familiarity that bred this indifference, but she thought not. For all his talk of embracing the miraculous, Charlie was still a pragmatist, fixed in the particular. Whatever forces moved here, and she felt them strongly, he was dead to their presence. Approaching the retreat, she thought the place windowless. But she'd been wrong. At the intersection of wall and dome ran a ring of windows, like a halo fitted to the chapel's skull. Small though they were, they let in sufficient light to strike the floor and rise up into the middle of the space, where the luminescence converged above the mosaic. If this was indeed a place of departure, that rarefied spot
was the platform.
"It's nothing special, is it?" Charlie observed.
She was about to disagree, searching for a way to express what she was feeling, when Skin began barking outside. This wasn't the excited yapping with which he'd announced each new pissing place along the way, but a sound of alarm. She started towards the door, but the hold the chapel had on her slowed her response, and Charlie was out before she'd reached the step, calling to the dog to be quiet. He stopped barking suddenly.
"Charlie?"
she said. There was no reply. With the dog quieted, she heard a greater quiet. The birds had stopped singing. Again, she said,
"Charlie?"
And as she did so, somebody stepped into the doorway. It was not Charlie. This man, bearded and heavy, was a stranger. But her system responded to the sight of him with a shock of recognition, as though he was some long-lost comrade. She might have thought herself crazy, except that what she felt was echoed on his face. He looked at her with narrowed eyes, turning his head a little to the side.
"You're Judith?"
"Yes, who are you?"
"Oscar Godolphin."
She let her shallow breaths go in favour of a deeper draught.
"Oh, thank God," she said. "You startled me. I don't know what I thought. Did the dog try and attack you?"
"Forget the dog," he said, stepping into the chapel. "Have we met before?"
"I don't believe so," she said. "Where's Charlie? Is he all right?"
Godolphin continued to approach her, his step steady.
"This confuses things," he said.
"What does?"
"Me, knowing you. You being whoever you are. It confuses things."
"I don't see why," she said. "I'd wanted to meet you, and I asked Charlie several times if he'd introduce us, but he always seemed reluctant."
She kept chattering, as much to defend herself from his appraisal as for communication's sake. She felt if she fell silent, she'd forget herself utterly, become his object.
"I'm very pleased we finally get to talk."
He was close enough to touch her now. She put out her hand to shake his.
"It really is a pleasure," she said.
Outside, the dog began barking again, and this time its din was followed by a shout.
"Oh, God, he's bitten somebody,"
Jude said, and started towards the door. Oscar took hold of her arm, and the contact, light but proprietorial, checked her. She looked back towards him, and all the laughable clichés of romantic fiction were suddenly real and deadly serious. Her heart was beating in her throat, her cheeks were beacons, the ground seemed uncertain beneath her feet. There was no pleasure in this, only a sickening powerlessness she could do nothing to defend herself against. Her only comfort, and it was small, was the fact that her partner in this dance of desire seemed almost as distressed by their mutual fixation as she. The dog's din was abruptly cut short, and she heard Charlie yell her name. Oscar's glance went to the door, and hers went with it, to see Esterbrook, armed with a cudgel of wood, gasping at the threshold. Behind him, an abomination, a half-burned creature, its face caved in. Charlie's doing, she saw, there were scraps of its blackened flesh on the cudgel, reaching blindly for him. She cried out at the sight, and he stepped aside as it lurched forward. It lost its balance on the step and fell. One hand, fingers burned to the bone, reached for the door jamb, but Charlie brought his weapon down on its wounded head. Skull shards flew, silvery blood preceded its head to the step, as its hand missed its purchase, and it collapsed on the threshold. She heard Oscar quietly moan.
"You fuckhead," Charlie said.
He was panting and sweaty, but there was a gleam of purpose in his eyes she'd never seen the like of.
"Let her go,"
he said. She felt Oscar's grip go from her arm and mourned its departure. What she'd felt for Charlie had been only a prophecy of what she felt now, as if she'd loved him in remembrance of a man she'd never met. And now that she had, now that she'd heard the true voice and not its echo, Esterbrook seemed like a poor substitute for all his tardy heroism. Where these feelings came from, she didn't know, but they had the force of instinct, and she would not be gainsaid. She stared at Oscar. He was overweight, overdressed, and doubtless overbearing, not the kind of individual she'd have sought out given the choice. But for some reason she didn't yet comprehend, she'd had that choice denied. Some urge profounder than conscious desire had claimed her will. The fears she had for Charlie's safety, and indeed for her own, were suddenly remote, almost abstractions.
"Take no notice of him," Charlie said. "He's not going to hurt you."
She glanced his way. He looked like a husk beside his brother, beset by ticks and tremors. How had she ever loved him?
"Come here,"
he said, beckoning to her. She didn't move, until Oscar said,
"Go on."
More out of obedience to his instruction than any wish to go, she started to walk towards Charlie. As she did so, another shadow fell across the threshold. A severely dressed young man with dyed blonde hair appeared at the door, the lines of his face perfect to the point of banality.
"Stay away, Dowd," Oscar said. "This is just Charlie and me."
Dowd looked down at the body on the step, then back at Oscar, offering two words of warning.
"He's dangerous."
"I know what he is," Oscar said. "Judith, why don't you step outside with Dowd?"
"Don't go near that little fucker," Charlie told her. "He killed Skin. And there's another of those things out there."
"They're called voiders, Charles," Oscar said, "and they're not going to harm a hair on her beautiful head. Judith, look at me."
She looked around at him.
"You're not in danger. You understand? Nobody's going to hurt you."
She understood and believed him. Without looking back at Charlie, she went to the door. The dog killer moved aside, offering her a hand to help her over the voider's corpse, but she ignored it and went out into the sun with a shameful lightness in her heart and step. Dowd followed her as she walked from the chapel. She felt his stare.
"Judith,"
he said, as if astonished.
"That's me,"
she replied, knowing that to lay claim to that identity was somehow momentous. Squatting in the humus a little way from them, she saw the other voider. It was idly perusing the body of Skin, running its fingers over the dog's flank. She looked away, unwilling to have the strange joy she felt soured by morbidity. She and Dowd had reached the edge of the wood, where she had an unhindered view of the sky. The sun was sinking, gaining colour as it fell and lending a new glamour to the vista of park, terraces and house.
"I feel as though I've been here before," she said.
The thought was strangely soothing. Like the feelings she had towards Oscar, it rose from some place in her she didn't remember owning, and identifying its source was not for now as important as accepting its presence. That she did, gladly. She'd spent so much of her recent life in the grip of events that lay outside her power to control, it was a pleasure to touch a source of feeling that was so deep, so instinctive, she didn't need to analyze its intentions. It was part of her and therefore good. Tomorrow, maybe, or the day after, she'd question its significance more closely.
"Do you remember anything specific about this place?" Dowd asked her.
She mused on this for a time, then said,
"No, it's just a feeling of belonging." "Then maybe it's better not to remember,"
came the reply.
"You know memory. It can be very treacherous."
She didn't like this man, but there was merit in his observation. She could barely remember 10 years of her own span. Thinking back beyond that would be near impossible. If the recollections came in the fullness of time, she'd welcome them. But for now she had a brimming cup of feelings, and perhaps they were all the more attractive for their mystery. There were raised voices from the chapel, though the echo within and the distance without made comprehension impossible.
"A little sibling rivalry," Dowd remarked. "How does it feel being a woman contested over?"
"There's no contest," she replied.
"They don't seem to think so," he said.
The voices were shouts now, rising to a pitch, then suddenly subdued. One of them went on talking, Oscar, she thought, interrupted by exhortations from the other. Were they bargaining over her, throwing their bids back and forth? She started to think she should intervene, go back to the chapel and make her allegiance, irrational as it was, quite plain.
Better to tell the truth now than let Charlie bargain away his goods and chattels, only to discover the prize wasn't his to have. She turned and began to walk towards the chapel.
"What are you doing?" said Dowd. "I have to talk to them. Mr. Godolphin told you—" "I heard him. I have to talk to them."
Off to her right she saw the voider rise from its haunches, its eyes not on her but on the open door. It sniffed the air, then let out a whistle, as plaintive as a whine, and started toward the building with a loping, almost bestial gait. It reached the door before Jude, stepping on its dead brother in its haste to be inside. As she came within a couple of yards of the door, she caught the scent that had set it whining. A breeze, too warm for the season and carrying perfumes too strange for this world, came to meet her out of the chapel, and to her horror she realized that history was repeating itself. The train between the dominions was being boarded inside, and the wind she smelled was blowing along the track from its destination.
"Oscar!"
she yelled, stumbling over the body as she threw herself inside. The travellers were already dispatched. She saw them passing from view like Gentle and Pie au Pas, except that the voider, desperate to go with them, was pitching itself into the flux of passage. She might have done the same, but that its error was evident. Caught in the flux, but too late to be taken where the travellers had gone, its whistle became a screech as it was unknitted. Its arms and head, thrust into the knot of power which marked the place of departure, began to turn inside out. Its lower half, untouched by the power, convulsed, its legs scrambling for purchase on the mosaic as it tried to retrieve itself. Too late. She saw its head and torso unveiled, saw the skin of its arms stripped and sucked away. The power that trapped it quickly died, but it was not so lucky. With its arms still clutching at the world it had perhaps glimpsed as its eyes went from its head, it dropped to the ground, the blue-black stew of its innards spilling across the mosaic. Even then, gutted and blind, its body refused to cease. It thrashed in its coils like the victims of a grand mal. Dowd stepped past her, approached the passing place cautiously, for fear the flux had left an echo, but finding none, drew a gun from inside his jacket and, eyeing some vulnerable place in the mess at his feet, fired twice. The voider's throes slowed, then stopped. Sighing heavily, Dowd stepped away from the body and returned to where Jude stood.
"You shouldn't be here," he said. "None of this is for your eyes."
"Why not? I know where they've gone."
"Oh, do you?"
he said, raising a quizzical eyebrow.
"And where's that?"
"To the Imagica," she said,
affecting complete familiarity with the notion, though it still astonished her. He made a tiny smile, though she wasn't sure whether it was one of acceptance or subtle mockery. He watched her study him, almost basking in her scrutiny, taking it, perhaps, for simple admiration.
"And how do you know about the Imagica?"
he inquired.
"Doesn't everybody?"
"I think you know better than that," he replied. "Though how much better, I'm not entirely sure."
She was something of an enigma to him, she suspected, and as long as she remained so, might hope to keep him friendly.
"Do you think they made it?" she asked.
"Who knows?
The voider may have spoilt their passage by trying to tag along. They may not have reached Isordorex."
"So where will they be?"
"In the Inovo, of course. Somewhere between here and the Second Dominion."
"And how will they get back?"
"Simple," he said.
"They won't."
4. So they waited. Or rather, she waited, watching the sun disappear behind trees blotted with rookeries and the evening stars appearing as light bringers in its place. Dowd busied himself dealing with the bodies of the voiders, dragging them out of the chapel, making a simple pyre of dead wood and burning them upon it. He showed not the least concern that she was witnessing this, which was a lesson and perhaps a warning to her. He apparently assumed she was part of the secret world he and the voiders occupied, not subject to the laws and moralities the rest of the world was bounded by. In seeing all she'd seen, and passing herself off as expert in the ways of the Imagica, she had become a conspirator. There was no way back after this, to the company she'd kept and the life she'd known. She belonged to the secret, every bit as much as the secret belonged to her. That of itself would be no great loss if Godolphin returned. He would help her find her way through the mysteries. If he didn't return, the consequences were less palatable. To be obliged to keep Dowd's company simply because they were fellow marginals would be unbearable. She would surely wither and die. But then if Godolphin was not in her life, what could that matter? From ecstasy to despair in the space of an hour. Was it too much to hope the pendulum would swing back the other way before the day was out? The chill was adding to her misery, and having no other source of warmth, she went over to the pyre, preparing to retreat if the scent or the sight was too offensive. But the smoke, which she'd expected to smell of burning meat, was almost aromatic, and the forms in the fire unrecognizable. Dowd offered her a cigarette, which she accepted, lighting it from a branch plucked from the edge of the fire.
"What were they?"
she asked him, eyeing the remains.
"You've never heard of voiders?" he said. "They're the lowest of the low. I brought them through from the Innovo myself, and I'm no maestro, so that gives an idea of how gullible they are.
When it smelled the wind—"
"Yes, that was rather touching, wasn't it?"
Dowd said.
"It smelled his Ordrex.
Maybe it was born there."
"Very possibly. I've heard it said they're made of collective desire. But that's not true. They're revenge children, got on women who are working the way for themselves."
"Working the way isn't good?"
"Not for your sex, it isn't. It's strictly forbidden."
"So somebody who breaks the laws made pregnant as revenge?"
"Exactly. You can't abort voiders, you see. They're stupid, but they fight, even in the womb. And killing something you gave birth to is strictly against the women's codes, so they pay to have the voiders thrown into the Innovo. They can survive there longer than just about anything. They feed on whatever they can find, including each other. And eventually, if they're lucky, they get summoned by someone in this dominion."
So much to learn, she thought. Perhaps she should cultivate Dowd's friendship, however charmless he was. He seemed to enjoy parading his knowledge, and the more she knew, the better prepared she'd be when she finally stepped through the door into his Ordrex. She was about to ask him something more about the city when a gust of wind blowing from out of the chapel threw a flurry of sparks up between them.
"They're coming back,"
she said, and started towards the building.
"Be careful," Dowd said. "You don't know it's them."
His warning went unheeded. She went to the door at a run and reached it as the spicy summer wind died away. The interior of the chapel was gloomy, but she could see a single figure standing in the middle of the mosaic. It staggered towards her, its breathing ragged. The light from the fire caught it as it came within 2 yards of her. It was Oscar Godolphin, his hand up to his bleeding nose.
"That bastard,"
he said.
"Where is he?"
"Dead," he said plainly. "I had to do it, Judith. He was crazy. God alone knows what he might have said or done."
He put his arm towards her.
"Will you help me? He damn near broke my nose."
"I'll take him," Dowd said possessively. He stepped past her, fetching a handkerchief from his pocket to put to Oscar's nose. It was waved away.
"I'll survive," Oscar said. "Let's just get home."
They were out of the chapel now, and Oscar was eyeing the fire.
"The voiders,"
Dowd explained. Oscar threw a glance at Judith.
"He made you pyre watch with him," he said. "I'm so sorry."
He looked back at Dowd, pained.
"There's no way to treat a lady," he said. "We're going to have to do better in future." "What do you mean? She's coming to live with us, aren't you, Judith?"
She hesitated a shamelessly short time, then she said,
"Yes, I am."
Satisfied, he went over to look at the pyre.
"Come back tomorrow," she heard him tell Dowd. "Scatter the ashes and bury the bones. I've got a little prayer book Peckable gave me. We'll find something appropriate in there."
While he spoke, she stared into the murk of the chapel, trying to imagine the journey that had been taken from here, and the city at the other end from which that tantalizing wind had blown. She would be there one day. She'd lost a husband in pursuit of passage, but from her present perspective, that seemed like a negligible loss. There was a new order of feeling in her, founded at the sight of Oscar Godolphin. She didn't yet know what he would come to mean to her, but perhaps she could persuade him to take her away with him, some day soon. Eager as she was to create in her mind's eye the mysteries that lay beyond the veil of the fifth, Jude's imagination, for all its fever, could never have conjured the reality of that journey. Inspired by a few clues from Dowd, she had imagined the inn over as a kind of wasteland, where voiders hung like drowned men in deep-sea trenches, and creatures the sun would never see crawled towards her, their paths lit by their own sickly luminescence. But the inhabitants of the Inovo beggared the bizarreness of any ocean floor. They had forms and appetites that no book had ever set down. They had rages and frustrations that were centuries old. And the scenes she'd imagined awaiting her on the other side of that prison were also very different from those she'd created. If she'd travelled on the Isordorexian Express, she would not have been delivered into the middle of a summer city, but into a dampish cellar, lined with the merchant peccables, forbidden cache of charms and petrifications. In order to reach the open air, she would have had to climb the stairs and pass through the house itself. Once she'd reached the street, she'd have found some of her expectations satisfied at least. The air was warm and spicy there, and the sky was bright. But it was not a sun that blazed overhead, it was a comet, trailing its glory across the Second Dominion. And if she stared at it a moment, then looked down at the street, she'd have found its reflection glittering in a pool of blood. Here was the spot where the brawl between Oscar and Charlie had ended, and where the defeated brother had been left. He'd not remained there for very long. News of a man dressed in foreign garb and dumped in the gutter had soon spread, and before the last of his blood had drained from his body, three individuals never before seen in this Kesperat had come to claim him. They were Dirthers, to judge by their tattoos, and had Jude been standing on Peckable's step watching the scene, she would have been touched to see how reverently they treated their burden as they spirited it away. How they smiled down at that bruised and lolling face, how one of them wept. She might also have noticed, though in the flurry of the street this detail might have escaped her eye, that though the defeated man lay quite still in the cradle his bearers made of their limbs, his eyes closed, his arms trailing until they were folded across his chest, said chest was not entirely motionless. Charles Estabrook, abandoned for dead in the filth of his Isordorex, left its streets with enough health in his body to be dubbed a loser, not a corpse. Chapter 22. 1. The days following Pi and Gentle's second departure from Beatrix seemed to shorten as they climbed, supporting the suspicion that the nights in the Jokalela were longer than those in the lowlands. It was impossible to confirm that this was so, because their two timekeepers, Gentle's beard and Pi's bowels, became increasingly unreliable as they climbed, the former because Gentle ceased to shave, the latter because the travellers' desire to eat, and thus their need to defecate, dwindled the higher they went. Far from inspiring appetite, the rarefied air became a feast in itself, and they travelled for hour upon hour without their thoughts once turning to physical need. They had each other's company, of course, to keep them from completely forgetting their bodies and their purpose, but more reliable still were the beasts on whose shaggy backs they rode. When the Doikai grew hungry, they simply stopped and would not be bullied or coaxed into moving from whatever bush or piece of pasture they'd found until they were sated. At first, this was an irritation, and the riders cursed as they slipped from their saddles on such occasions, knowing they had an idling hour ahead while the animals grazed. But as the days passed and the air grew thinner, they came to depend upon the rhythm of the Doikai's digestive tracts, and made such stopping places mealtimes for themselves. It soon became apparent that Pi's calculations as to the length of this journey had been hopelessly optimistic. The only part of the mischief's predictions that experience was confirming was the hardship. Even before they reached the snow line, both riders and mounts were showing signs of fatigue, and the track they were following became less visible by the mile as the soft earth chilled and froze, refusing the traces of those who had preceded them. With the prospect of snowfields and glaciers ahead, they rested the Doikai for a day and encouraged the beasts to gorge themselves on what would be the last available pasture until they reached the other side of the range. Gentle had called his mount Chester, after dear old Klein, with whom it shared a certain ruminative charm. Pi declined to name the other beast, however, claiming it was bad luck to eat anything you knew by name, and circumstances might very well oblige them to dine on Doikai meat before they reached the borders of the Third Dominion. That small disagreement aside, they kept their exchanges frictionless when they set off again, both consciously skirting any discussion of the events in Beatrix or their significance. The cold soon became aggressive, the coats they'd been given barely adequate defence against the assault of winds that blew up walls of dusty snow so dense they often obliterated the way ahead. When that happened, Pi pulled out the compass, the face of which looked more like a star map to Gentle's untutored eye, and assessed their direction from that. Only once did Gentle remark that he hoped the mischief knew what it was doing. Earning such a withering glance for his troubles, it silenced him utterly on the matter thereafter. Despite weather that was worsening by the day, making Gentle think wistfully of an English January, good fortune did not entirely desert them. On the fifth day beyond the snow line, in a lull between gusts, Gentle heard bells ringing, and following the sound they discovered a group of half a dozen mountain men tending to a flock of 100 or more cousins to the terrestrial goat, these shaggier by far and purple as crocuses. The herders spoke no English, and only one of them, whose name was Kuthus, and who boasted a beard as shaggy and as purple as his beasts, leading Gentle to wonder what marriages of convenience had occurred in these lonely uplands, had any words in his vocabulary that Pi could comprehend. What he told was grim. The herders were bringing their herds down from the high pass early, because the snow had covered ground the beasts would have grazed for another 20 days in a normal season. This was not, he repeated several times, a normal season. He had never known the snow to come so early or fall so copiously, never known the winds to be so bitter. In essence, he advised them not to attempt the route ahead. It would be tantamount to suicide. Pi and Gentle talked this advice over. The journey was already taking far longer than they'd anticipated. If they went back down below the snow line, tempting as the prospect of relative warmth and fresh food was, they were wasting yet more time. Days when all manner of horrors could be unfolding, 100 villages like Beatrix destroyed, and countless lives lost.
"Remember what I said when we left Beatrix?" Gentle said.
"No, to be honest, I don't.
I said we wouldn't die, and I meant it. We'll find a way through.
I'm not sure I like this messianic conviction," Pi said. "People with the best intentions die, Gentle. Come to think of it, they're often the first to go."
"What are you saying? That you won't come with me?"
"I said I'd go wherever you go, and I will. But good intentions won't impress the cold."
"How much money have we got?"
"Not much."
"Enough to buy some goat skins off these men? And maybe some meat?"
The complex exchange ensued in 3 languages, with Pi translating Gentle's words into the language Kuthus understood, and Kuthus in turn translating for his fellow herders. A deal was rapidly struck. The herders seemed much persuaded by the prospect of hard cash. Rather than give over their own coats, however, 2 of them got about the business of slaughtering and skinning 4 of the animals. The meat they cooked and shared among the group. It was fatty and underdone, but neither Gentle nor Pi declined, and it was washed down with a beverage they brewed from boiled snow, dried leaves, and a dash of liquor which Pi understood Kuthus to have called the piss of the goat. They tasted it in spite of this. It was potent, and after a shot of it, downed like vodka, Gentle remarked that if this made him a piss drinker, so be it. The next day, having been supplied with skins, meat, and the makings of 7 pots of the herder's beverage, plus a pan and 2 glasses, they made their inarticulate farewells and parted company. The weather closed in soon after, and once again they were lost in a white wilderness. But their spirits had been buoyed up by the meeting, and they made steady progress for the next 2.5 days, until, as twilight approached on the 3rd, The animal Gentle was riding started to show signs of exhaustion, its head drooping, its hooves barely able to clear the snow they were trudging through.
"I think we'd better rest him," Gentle said.
They found a niche between boulders so large they were almost hills in themselves, and lit a fire to brew up some of the herder's liquor. It, more than the meat, was what had sustained them through the most demanding portions of the journey so far, but try as they might to use it sparingly, they had almost consumed their modest supply. As they drank, they talked about what lay ahead. Kuthus's predictions were proving correct. The weather was worsening all the time, and the chances of encountering another living soul up here if they were to get into difficulty were surely zero. Pi took a moment to remind Gentle of his conviction that they weren't going to die. Come blizzard, come hurricane, come the echo of Hapexamendios himself down from the mountain.
"And I meant what I said," Gentle replied. "But I can still fret about it, can't I?"
He put his hands closer to the fire.
"Any more in the piss-pot?" "I'm afraid not." "I tell you, when we come back this way—"
Pi made a wry face.
"We will, we will. When we come back this way, we've got to get the recipe. Then we can brew it back on Earth."
They'd left the Doekai a little distance away and heard now a lowing sound.
"Chester,"
Gentle said, and went to the beasts. Chester was lying on its side, its flank heaving. Blood streamed from its mouth and nose, melting the snow it poured upon.
"Oh, shit, Chester," Gentle implored. "Don't die."
But he'd no sooner put what he hoped was a comforting hand on the Doekai's flank than it turned its glossy brown eye towards him, let out one final moan, and stopped breathing.
"We just lost 50% of our transport," he said to Pi.
"Look on the bright side. We gained ourselves a week of meat."
Gentle glanced back towards the dead animal, wishing he'd taken Pi's advice and never named the beast. Now when he sucked its bones, he'd be thinking of Klein.
"Will you do it or should I?"
he said.
"I suppose it should be me. I named him. I should skin him."
The mistiff didn't argue, only suggested that it should move the other animal out of sight of the scene in case it, too, lost all will to live, seeing its comrade disemboweled. Gentle agreed and watched while Pi led the fretting creature away. Wielding the blade they'd been given as they left Beatrix, he then set about his butchering. He rapidly discovered that neither he nor the knife were equal to the task. The Doekai's hide was thick, its fat rubbery, its meat tough. After an hour of hacking and tearing, he'd only managed to strip the hide from the upper half of its back leg and a small portion of its flank. He was sticky with its blood and sweating inside his coat of furs.
"Shall I take over?"
Pi suggested.
"No,"
Gentle snapped.
"I can do it,"
and continued to labour in the same inept fashion, the blade dulled by now and the muscles driving it weary. He waited a decent interval, then got up and went back to the fire where Pi was sitting gazing into the flames. Disgruntled by his defeat, he tossed the knife down in the melting snow beside the fire.
"I give up," he said. "It's all yours."
Somewhat reluctantly, Pi picked up the knife, proceeded to sharpen it on the rock face, then went to work. Gentle didn't watch. Repulsed by the blood that had spattered him, he elected to brave the cold and wash it off. He found a place a little way from the fire, where the ground was untrammeled, removed his coat and shirt and knelt down to bathe in the snow. His skin crawled at the chill, but some urge to self-mortification was satisfied by this testing of will and flesh, and when he'd cleaned his hands and face, he rubbed the pricking snow into his chest and belly, though the Doekai's fluids hadn't stained him there. The wind had dropped in the last little while, and the sky visible between the rocks was more gold than green. He was seized by the need to stand unencumbered in its light.